Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 10th, 2002. Today's session is titled Empowering Images, TV and Social Change, Session 5, and Justice for All, presented by John DeGraff. The number is DEJ2002-06. Let's listen in.
We have to do with our responsibility as Christians to the poor and oppressed and to social justice, which we haven't gone into too much in the earlier programs. And I'm going to show you clips from two films that I made in the mid and late 1980s that I think, though, are still relevant today in terms of the content that they explore. And the first film, the first excerpt is from a film called God and Money. And the title comes from the message, which actually in the film is delivered by a Catholic priest, that you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. You have to choose one or the other. And the film is an exploration of an event that was taking place in the Catholic Church nationally in 1984, 1985, 1986. As the Catholic bishops were writing an encyclical letter about poverty and justice, and really the church's response at that time to the policies of Reaganomics and trickle-down economics. And this was an issue that the entire church was engaged in. Catholic churches throughout the country had discussions of these drafts of the bishop's letter and made their comments. And the final letter called Archbishop's letter and Justice for All, I think is a terrific document in terms of Christian responsibility for justice in the economy. But the section that I'm going to show you is a 15-minute look at one community in Texas, in San Antonio, where organizations built around Catholic parishes actually helped organize the disempowered Hispanic community in San Antonio to have at least a much more of a measure of control over the events taking place in the city and fairness. It was an organization called Communities Organized for Public Service, or COPS. And it was based on the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was founded by the great organizer Saul Alinsky to empower people in poor communities. Before I show it, I just want to mention a couple of terms. You're going to hear the Campaign for Human Development mentioned, and that's the Catholic Church's anti-poverty arm, which is purpose was to empower poor people to have a fairer stake in our economic system. Second, you'll also hear reference to the Weakland Committee's letter, and Archbishop Weakland of Milwaukee was the leading bishop on this letter that was being put out. So when you hear that, it's the letter that's being discussed in parishes, and you'll see some discussion of that in San Antonio. So I'm going to show that now, and then we'll have a little time to talk about it, and then I'm just going to show one other clip, and it's from a story. It's a story about Guatemalan refugees in Mexico and what they went through in a war that in part was of American making, I think.
As a purpose, there are people that should do it, but it doesn't break the chains of poverty. In order to make change, you have to have power. In order to have power, you have to be organized.
During the past decade, Beatrice Court
is happening. No video.
Could it be something on this one?
There's a supposed blue light is not on.
So it's
the switch on top of it.
Is it?
Sometimes it's turned on, but
Yeah, turn it on. That was off. You have to do it.
If you hear the fan running and it's on,
it can go
into a sleep mode, I think. And it takes a little bit to come out.
Sure.
There's something.
Because when you just hit the button before, it went off.
No, yeah, it's totally off now. You want to hit that button again and see if the blue light comes on? Huh.
If it's depressed, it's on.
It's depressed.
Okay, I'll get the audio vision.
Is it plugged in?
This happened to me one time, but then it came on. But the cap is off, the lens cap is off.
The lens cap's off.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, initially the blue light was on.
I know, this did happen to me. It goes to sleep, and I don't know how you wake it up. But if you press play, it won't just come on.
I think you need to wait.
Well, it didn't.
Yeah.
But the blue light is on. Well,
now it appears to be totally off.
Yeah, now it's off.
The blue light is on for a bit, and then something went off, and there's no video.
It's missing.
Yeah, it's missing.
Sorry
about that, John.
Okay. Oh, just that cord got loose?
I had taken it out from the 9 o'clock session and forgot you needed it, so it just needed that adapter. Ah.
Looks like it's gonna work.
Now if you hit play, it should
show. Okay.
Organized. As a member and a past president of the Campaign for Human Development's greatest success story, a citizens' organization that changed a city. City with a Mexican flavor. Old world charm brings tourists to the Riverwalk. Historical legend draws them to the Alamo.
You see, all the propaganda about how great San Antonio is, but it has its sins. And there is a shadow side. And it's our people who live in that shadow side. It's God's people who live in that shadow side.
Don't forget to go for the bond. The bond is very important to also the many streets and villages.
In a poor Mexican-American barrio of San Antonio, Virginia Ramirez of COPS, Communities Organized for Public Service, goes door to door asking her neighbors to vote for a municipal bond. Catholic bishops say poor Americans can empower themselves to be full participants in our economic and political life by working together for change. COPS is one example of what they mean. Twelve years ago, the first COPS organizers went door to door here, laying the groundwork for an organization that would bring political power to San Antonio's Hispanic majority. In those days, the Hispanics of San Antonio felt powerless and forgotten. Each year on Good Friday, they remember how it was.
We were treated as objects rather than people. I used to hear comments when I was younger, oh, it's okay, he's just a Mexican.
San Antonio's Mexican-Americans had many burdens. Employers who wouldn't hire them, banks who wouldn't lend money in their neighborhoods, poor housing, and wages that were among the lowest in America.
They were very busy advertising that San Antonio was a place to come and build industry because you could find cheap Mexican and black labor.
Every year, the people of the barrios re- reenact the crucifixion of Christ. For them, the scene evokes memories of terrible conditions once passively endured.
There was no sidewalks. I didn't know where the sidewalk was.
The trash used to not get picked up. The streets were never repaired. The drainage was horrible.
You could say it looked like a third world country.
And the city really was not doing anything to alleviate those situations.
And it wasn't that people didn't care. It was that we didn't know how to organize. We didn't know how to fight.
People here often cried for victims of floodwaters, disease, or despair. Many grew hopeless and looked for a better life in other cities. But a few individuals, leaders in local Catholic churches, believed they could change San Antonio.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses.
The first COPS organizers, armed with funding from the Campaign for Human Development, began to mobilize their neighbors.
People were skeptics, and they were saying, an organization like COPS will never come to be because Mexican Americans are about two things. They're about family and they're about church, and so you will never get them involved in meetings.
But what some saw as a problem, COPS organizers saw as an opportunity. They began to look to religious leaders to encourage participation in the new organization. In parishes throughout San Antonio, the clergy responded.
Porque están luchando conmigo a mejorar mi vida.
Most of San Antonio's Catholic churches joined COPS, each pledging a portion of their annual income to support the organization.
In the beginning, COPS had been used some pretty strong tactics to get the attention of the community, both the press and the powers that be.
Jan Jarro of the San Antonio Express News remembers some of those tactics.
They were trying to dramatize the need for jobs in their areas. And so they took 300 COPS people, went down to a major downtown department store, Joski's, and tried on clothes. It's called a tie-up. They just literally stopped all activity in the department store for several hours and then they left.
There were nuns that were kind of trying on bits and pieces of bridal gowns, and there were people who were picking up coats, and everybody was putting everything back, but nobody was buying anything.
They went to the largest bank in San Antonio at the time, Frost Bank, and made change. Just tied up all the tellers for an hour or two making change. That got a lot of our attention.
And we found out that actually our money was being used in Dallas for big industry and in other places and so on. So we said, unless we can, unless that money can be lent back to the community, we probably will simply boycott the banks.
Civic leaders began to listen. Thousands of people joined COPS. Quickly, they were trained to confront politicians and business people with facts and finesse.
We are, in a sense, at the University of COPS. We learn about issues, we know how to address them, we research them. We can take contracts apart and look at the positives and the negatives.
As a result of our involvement with COPS, people who never would stand up in front of the church people, let alone the mayor, are not afraid to do that.
Municipal and business services in Barrios improved dramatically. creating a new sense of power. More Mexican-Americans began voting, electing candidates sympathetic to cops. The organization won victory after victory. New drainage projects stopping the flooding that had always plagued poorer sections of the city. New parks, schools, and libraries. Better jobs and improved housing.
In issues that we address, like utility rates, all of the city benefits because we keep utility rates down.
COPS has had tremendous success in the last 12 years here in San Antonio. And I think that this COPS is a real model for other cities, for other organizations, to learn how it can be done, that it is possible to organize support.
Supports the Wheatland Committee's letter. He and other COPS leaders agree with its emphasis on empowering the poor.
We are just excited about it, and we're spending a lot of time trying to let people know about the letter. We're passing it out in English and in Spanish in bits and pieces and having these sessions, workshops on the pastoral letter.
At one such workshop, Orobasso prepares COPS members to encourage San Antonio's Archbishop to defend the letter.
For a few minutes, you are the Archbishop of San Antonio. And I want you to think the way he thinks. I want you to talk the way he talks.
Your Excellency, I'm Rosemary Garza.
Hija. Don't say Excellency. I am Patrick Torres.
Oh, okay, Patrick Torres.
Really, watch this. Archbishop, in your letter, you talk to us about unemployment. We know about unemployment, don't we?
Yes.
In your letter, you talk to us about the lack of jobs in the city of San Antonio. And we know about jobs here in San Antonio, don't we?
Yes.
We want to tell the Archbishop, we know that they're going to go and some people are going to try to change the letter. We want to be very clear on what we believe are the essential elements in that letter. You talked about how work, that we have a right to work, and that's essential to our dignity as human beings. Don't let them change that, right?
Right.
You talk about a family wage. This is something new, and a lot of business people are going to talk against you. Please, don't let them change that. Right?
Right.
We cannot just read this letter and not do anything about it. Like all of you know, if you get a love letter and you read it, you expect something's going to come afterwards. It's not just words on a piece of paper. There's some kind of relationship that's going to be established. Well, this is a love letter from our bishops to us. And now we want to respond in action.
In the spring of 1985, action for COPS meant working to pass the bond, $100 million in capital improvements that would bring needed services to the barrios.
What are the enemies of this bond? I mean, what are the attitudes that you're going to be fighting when you walk for the bond?
We got the
anti-tax attitude. Lots of people are saying that taxes should not go up. What is the COPS philosophy about tax?
They're going to take.
We don't mind paying for it as long as we know where it's going.
The reason we want the bond so fast is because that money is going to come into our community.
Don't be fooled by this business about city waste. You have proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that COPS knows how to do capital improvements. COPS knows how to spend money on streets and on drainage, and it hasn't stopped you yet. $500 million. Almost any one of you can point to the streets and the drainage projects in your own neighborhoods. We have got to have this $100 million insurance policy for our communities. And without it, we don't have anything. There is no alternative. And if we don't pass this bond, then on April 7th, there will be nothing for drainage, for streets, for police protection, and for the other essential elements of the quality of life in our communities.
Election day, the Saturday before Easter. Polls predict a close vote count on the bonds as COPS activists prepare to turn out the people in their neighborhoods.
Those of you that are going to be way over there on the west side know that the east side is going to be working because
COPS members wondered anxiously whether their efforts would be rewarded.
Que la luz de Cristo resucitado y glorioso.
That night, in the barrios of San Antonio, the hope of Easter took on an earthly aspect as well. The results were in. The Bonds had won by a margin of 2-1. The next morning, George Osuna and his family, all active members of COPS, attend Easter Mass. George once thought his only hope for a better economic future was to leave San Antonio. But having seen what COPS has accomplished, he now feels differently.
People now have hope. They have a sense of that if we continue doing what we're doing, things will get a lot better and our lives will be enriched. COPS also give me a sense of power, that we can do something, that we can change our lives, that we can have an impact on our future. And that used to be in the hands of somebody else, but now it's in our hands. Now we control our destiny.
Just a little update. Only a few weeks ago, I spoke to Jan Jarbo, the reporter, who is still with the San Antonio Express News, and in fact now is a national columnist in many papers. She's her column is featured in our Seattle Post-Intelligencer. But I asked Jan what was happening with COPS because I really hadn't had any contact, and she said, "Oh, the organization is now they've now been around 29 years, and she says they're still really going strong, and they have a whole new generation of leaders who are working on other kinds of issues." There was a period in the late 1980s in which COPS thinks in San Antonio suddenly kind of got bad. There was the introduction of crack cocaine into the communities, and it had a really negative effect, and a lot of the work that COPS had done almost looked like it was going to go under. But they've come through that, and Jan says it's really impressive what they're doing now. And the organization has spawned other organizations, Valley Interfaith, which is along the Rio Grande Valley, where Mayor Beth Larkin, who is the director of COPS, is now the director of that organization. Big organizations in Los Angeles and other communities, kind of based on this model of the churches. Any questions about this particular? Yes.
Is this type of thing happening elsewhere in the United States?
Well, that's what I mentioned. Just at this point, there are in San Antonio, the Protestant churches in the black community formed their own organization based on the COPS model and began to do the same thing in that community. In the Rio Grande Valley, there's an organization, a big organization called UNO, United Neighborhoods Organization in Los Angeles, which is a Hispanic organization based in the churches. There's a group called BUILD, Baltimoreans United, and I don't remember all the initials, but that's based in the churches in Baltimore, another in Brooklyn, I mean,
Portland also. Portland Organizing Project. There's a number of Lutheran congregations involved in that effort.
Oh, great. That's great to hear. I wasn't familiar with that. So, as you could see, an awful lot of the leadership for COPS came from the women in the community, and who were activists in the church to begin with. And the first organizers, Ernie Cortez, who was who had lived in San Antonio and then gone to Chicago and received training from Saul Alinsky in organizing, and then went back to his community, knew that there were two types of people that he really wanted to concentrate his efforts on. One was the parish priests. He needed to get them on board because they obviously have a huge amount of clout. The other thing was the female leadership in the parishes, because these were the people who were doing a lot of the day-to-day work. And so of the first five COPS presidents, four of them were women. Only the very first was a guy, but from that point on, most of the COPS presidents had been women. And often these were people who before were pretty shy. I mean, they did all this kind of work in the church, the day-to-day work of building a church, but they would, the idea of actually going out and speaking in public and taking on the mayor or the council and things, completely foreign to them. One thing, though, is that it didn't come without a cost sometimes in some of those families, because there were, I talked to a couple of the former women presidents of COPS who ended up their husbands just could not conceive of them in any kind of, they had a very kind of macho husbands who couldn't conceive of them in any sort of leadership role like this and doing this and really couldn't handle it. And in a couple of cases, it resulted in splitting the family. But that I think was not the rule, but it showed that it's not necessarily easy to make this happen.
What about men's organizations like the Lutheran Layman's League? Are they doing anything?
I don't have an answer to that. Does anybody know?
I don't think they're doing much community organizing.
I mean, it's definitely something to think about, and the models have been there around for a while now, and they really do concentrate a lot on trying to discern people's values and what's important to them in building them.
There is a new book, though, out by a new staff person on ELC and national staff. I can't remember the name of the person on the book, but there's a new office for community organizing. They've just produced a book that's supposedly pretty good. I haven't seen it.
Oh, great.
But it's about congregational-based community organizing.
Great. Yeah, well, I was just very impressed in talking with these people. I spent some time after that in San Antonio and actually wrote a screenplay that still may someday be made into a film based on this. It got close to being actually produced by the American Experience, which is a PBS dramatic film series, but in the end they decided it was too costly, that they didn't have the money, especially because one of the scenes in it involves a flood. And although you can do that now considerably less expensively with computer graphics and everything than you could back in 1988 or 89 when I wrote that, it still was costly. The second clip that I'm going to show you is from a film called Return of the Maya. And this one was a project that was brought to my attention by a woman from Portland who spent some time in Guatemalan refugee camps in Mexico. In the early 80s, many of the Mayan Indians, particularly Guatemala, were forced to leave their country to flee. Many were killed in a war against the poor. There was done primarily because many of these people had done the same kind of community organizing that you see here in the churches and other things, and organized cooperatives and various things that threatened the wealthy elite in Guatemala and the landowners and so forth. And so you have many of these people had also kind of demanded some kind of reform, which was not granted, and then some of them turned to going to the mountains and becoming part of guerrilla organizations. So the army had a war ongoing with these Guatemalan guerrillas, but they didn't simply go out and fight the guerrillas in combat. They just simply burned down entire villages. Some 440 villages were simply just burned to the ground, people shot, women and children, others fled because the guerrillas were seen to be kind of fish among the the people here and the villages. And the village were accused of harboring these guerrillas. So, terrible situation. The interesting thing about this project was that the Mayan refugees were involved in a wonderful activity that was helping restore their sense of pride and their heritage, and also giving them a little money to get by. It was a UN effort to restore an ancient Mayan city called Edsna, which has been done now by the refugees, many of whom have returned to Guatemala. So it was kind of a fascinating project with the really bad, horrendous side, but also this positive side of these people coming in connection with their heritage, rebuilding this beautiful, this incredible city. And so that's why we chose that particular camp. And certainly spending time there in the camp is an opener for me, just about the lives of the people and all that had happened to them. So I'm going to show you some of this. I haven't decided exactly where to shut it off, but I'll probably show 10 minutes or so, and then we can have a little discussion about that and early today, probably.
Each year, the villages of Quetzal Isna gather to watch the deer dance, a remnant of the ancient indigenous pageantry of the Americas. Since the 16th century Spanish conquest of the Guatemalan highlands, this dance has contained symbols of Indian resistance, cues meant to be understood only by the Maya. Some dancers wear costumes originally designed to flatter Spanish overlords, but the comic abduction of a hunter carries a message of mockery. Long before Columbus, the Maya were lords of a vast empire, encompassing much of what is now Central America and the Yucatan Peninsula. Yet for nearly 500 years, they've been treated as second-class citizens in their own lands. Quetzal Isna, a refugee camp near the Mexican city of Campeche, is home to several thousand Guatemalan exiles. Throughout the world, 17 million uprooted people live in camps like this one. Jointly administered by the United Nations and by a Mexican government agency called COMAR, the camp is Spartan, but well organized by the refugees themselves. Rosa Lopez prepares the meal, while her husband Jose watches. They speak Ishido, one of 30 living languages of the Maya family. Today's meal is special. There are eggs to go with the corn tortillas that provide the heart of the refugee diet. The ancient Maya believed their gods fashioned human beings from corn. Their descendants here can afford little else. After lunch, the Lopez family joins others at Quetzal Isna's small cemetery. It is November the 2nd, the Day of the Dead. The refugees gather at the graves of relatives to honor them. In times like this, they most vividly remember Guatemala. In the
early 1980s, Guatemala was a nation at war.
They killed many people with machetes, and they burned people in their houses.
The troubles began a decade earlier, when urban workers, students, and peasants challenged military rule and the most unequal distribution of land and income in Central America.
The peasants organized and protested with strikes. They formed committees asking for better food, for schools, for roads, for electric power in the poorer areas.
The military's response was a wave of repression.
Labor leader, Catholic priest, newspaper person, a lawyer who supported the workers, anybody who dared to speak out for the poor was being picked up.
Frustrated in their efforts to achieve peaceful reform, many peasants joined leftist guerrilla movements. Guatemala's military leaders declared all-out war against them. Entire villages suspected of sympathy with the rebels were attacked by the army.
444, I think, was the count of villages that were totally destroyed. Girls were coming to the house crying and weeping, saying they had seen massacres, they had seen their family killed, they had seen whole villages being burned.
I saw that they were burning. They were burning my neighbor. So I said, it's best we go right away. And I pulled together all my family and we just left everything.
At least 75,000 people died. 40,000 disappeared. Hardest hit were Guatemala's poorest people, the Maya. More than 100,000 of them sought refuge in Mexico. At first, the refugees were housed in camps near the border, but land shortages and continued attacks on the camps by the Guatemalan troops who crossed the unprotected Mexican frontier brought a change. In 1984, many of the refugees were uprooted once again, moved from the border state of Chiapas to scattered sites in the Yucatan Peninsula. Their first shelters were rough warehouses.
Fue una vida muy triste. Toda la gente ahí estábamos sufriendo de tanto de comida y como de dormir.
It was a very sad life. All of us suffered from a lack of food and from sleeping problems. Many of the children appeared to be very sick. We lived like that for more than a month before they moved us to this camp in Quetzal.
They started all over again, building wooden houses, digging wells, planting fruit trees and gardens, trying hard to maintain their traditions in a new environment. The new camp was named for the nearby Etzna ruins and for the Quetzal, Guatemala's colorful national bird, which always dies in captivity. Opportunities for gainful employment here are few. Unskilled labor in surrounding fields or in nearby towns. Yet the people of Quetzal Etzna have a reason for optimism. For the past few years, teams of about 30 men from Quetzal Etzna have been restoring the ancient Mayan ruins that lie only a few miles from the refugee camp. The director of the project is a young Mexican archaeologist, Dr. Antonio Benavides.
We are looking for several walls, several other rooms that haven't been excavated. And this typical architecture is of late classic, I mean 600 to 900 after Christ. this hill disappeared because here at the Great Acropolis we have several other families of temples.
Okay, now. Because we have just a nice hill with a vegetation.
It was inspiring to see this, and I've had friends who have gone to that city in recent years and say that it's really quite something that the refugees achieved. And they have now gone back to Guatemala. There was a repatriation of refugees, and initially there were some problems. I hear, though, that most of the people have been doing okay, but most recently, there's new trouble again in Guatemala, new repression, and one wonders what will happen. It's a very interesting thing about the war in the early 80s, first in the late 70s and then in the early 80s. Many of these Guatemalan officers who had been trained at the School of Americas, which some of you heard of, the tactics to fight the guerrillas, including things like torture techniques and other kinds of things. In the late 70s, they didn't receive direct U.S. military aid because the Carter administration had a human rights policy that said we're not going to give direct military aid to these terrorist regimes, of which the Guatemalan military was one. It had already been killing quite a few of its people even in the 70s. However, the U.S. military kind of found a way to work around that particular policy. They got the Israelis to actually take our place, and in return for giving money and assistance to Israel, the Israelis gave their Uzis and other money and military equipment to the Guatemalan military, so that the repressions in the late 70s and early 80s were conducted primarily with weapons from Israel. After Reagan came in 1981, he simply said, well, he didn't go along with the Carter policy and he was going to go back to them. So then we began simply funding directly from the U.S. again, the Guatemalan military. But incredibly repressive situation. They are still finding mass graves of people in Guatemala who were the victims of all of this. Any questions about this one?
Doesn't put the Mexican military in very good light.
Pardon?
Doesn't put the Mexican military in very good light, ethically or...
Well, the Mexican military, in a way, in this particular situation, they was moving these refugees. They were doing it for their protection because the Guatemalans would sometimes come across the border and attack the camps. I actually think that the Mexican government, given its resources and everything, was to be lauded for the work that they did do. I think that the people who were there working in the camps and stuff, with very few resources, the Mexican government people were really playing quite a positive role in working with the UN. The woman that you saw at the end, who plays a role later in the film, was an actress from Finland, Arja Saijonmaa, who is the United Nations Goodwill Ambassador for Refugees, and she happened to be trapped there at the camp and was speaking for a time around the world on this issue. I'm not sure whether she's still doing that, but she was the person who really found us the funds to finish this production. And we had a British narrator because the film actually had much more circulation in Europe than it did in the United States, and they're more used to the British English. This whole Central American thing seemed to be something that Americans didn't want to pay a lot of attention to.
I kind of have a more general question about the issue of funding and the prospect for these kinds of films in the future, and the willingness of Congress to continue to fund public broadcasting and so forth. How do things look from your standpoint?
Well, I'd say that public broadcasting for the next few years is probably going to kind of remain on a level. It took big hits in the early 80s. It took some more big hits in the mid-90s when the Gingrich Congress came in. And then some of that came back in the latter Clinton years. And it's kind of, but it's much below. And if you really look at funding in this country for public broadcasting, we spend about, I think at last count, it was about just over a dollar per American per year on public broadcasting. Now, you contrast that with the BBC, what the British do, they spend about the equivalent of $30 US per person per year on their public broadcasting system. And that's very, again, typical throughout Europe, where there's much more funding. The British do it with a tax on television sets that are bought. And anytime you buy a TV set, you pay a tax that then goes into a trust fund for public broadcasting. There are people here who would like to see something like that happen. We actually create a trust fund so we could have continued public broadcasting where we wouldn't have to be so totally dependent on either corporate generosity and appeals to or this sort of thing, which makes all of you sick, I'm sure, this kind of, you know, every other month pitch, you know, where we kind of hold out a cup and beg for weeks on end, and, you know, between programs and this thing they call pledge. Nobody likes it. I mean, viewers hate it. We hate to do it. But it now really supplies about 60 or more percent of the money that any station has. So if we were to stop it, we wouldn't have the programming. We need some other kind of alternative. And what's interesting here is that the Telecommunications Acts have basically just given away the public airwaves, just vast amounts of things that the commons that should have been owned by the public and at least we should have gotten something for. We've given them away free to the big corporate broadcasters. And hopefully at some point that can be reversed and we can actually at least put some kind of tax on the use of the public airwaves and then create a trust fund with that. I don't know if it's going to happen. In the meantime,
would you say the funding is available, say today, to make these kinds of films the way it was in 1990, 1980, or is it diminished?
That's a kind of a hard call. I mean, I think there's less, but there's a lot more competition. I mean, it's if I look at my own experience, it's probably roughly similar. I think it's harder now because there's so many more people applying and trying to make films. The video revolution, and particularly the low-cost kinds of very good video, which exists now, so that, you know, with a $3,500 camera today, you can get better pictures than we were getting with a $35,000 camera, you know, 10 years ago. That's all produced by a lot of people who want to make films and who are competing for the existing dollars. So the advantage is now I have something of a track record. I've been at it for a while. So, but I find it fairly similar. I do think the money out there is probably about the same, but if you look at real dollar terms, less today.
Mm-hmm. So what are you working on now and what can you look forward to in the future?
I'm working on several video projects, actually just finishing a piece for the State Department of Ecology in Washington on urban pesticides. They're very interested in getting people to garden organically because of the impact of all of this stuff on particularly salmon streams in Washington State and health and many other things. The State Department of Ecology is a big push by many of these agencies to try to get this. They now find, for instance, that there's far more pesticide residues in urban and suburban streams than there are in agricultural areas. Mm-hmm. Many, many more kinds, much heavier use on lawns and things like that. These are far more the culprits, really, in damaging the environment than what the farmers are doing out there. That's something that people aren't really aware of. I mean, you may not notice it as much because it's not in your food, but it's into into the water and into the environment. I'm doing also working on a piece funded by the Rockefeller Foundation on the unfinished campaign to end world hunger and some of the things that it might take if we're to try to get hunger under the situation where people can be adequately fed. And then the Ford Foundation, I've just got some support from the Ford Foundation to do develop a 2-hour documentary on ecological and social labeling, the issues of certified wood and fair trade shade grown coffee, for example, and how consumers might be able to influence the global marketplace by the choices that they make, knowing how these goods were produced, you know, how fairly workers were treated, what the impact was in the environment, and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Is it true, going back to the point you made right before this last one, that there is enough food to go around for everybody in the world, it just isn't distributed properly?
That is true. We do have at this point, if you take the world's production of food, enough calories to feed everybody. It's not quite that simple because we're not simply going to, I mean, the distribution and the money to buy food is a key thing. That poor people just don't have that. Also, you know, the food is in some places and not as easy to get to other places, and there are other issues. So I think what we need, it's true that the most important things I think that can be done now have to do with sharing the existing food more equitably and getting it to people who need it, making it possible for them to control their lands and things so they can grow food for themselves, not always for export. But I also think that in the future, we will need to produce more food, and so we need crop breeding and other kinds of things because population is continuing to expand and the amount of arable land is continuing to shrink.
Mm-hmm. A related issue to that has been the genetically modified foods and the debate around that, and whether countries, even second, third world countries, want to receive those kinds of foods. And so I'm wondering if you have done or if there are films that deal with that topic.
There are a few films that deal with it. I think that the issue has become so polarized in some ways that there's an awful lot of heat and very little light generated on both sides about terms involving biotechnology and food. You know, the Monsanto and company and those folks would like you to believe that biotechnology is going to be the savior of hungry people all over the world. And I think that there's very little prospect that in fact is the case, that it's mostly, at least certainly as it's being used today, it's being used to enrich people who already have. And on the other hand, I think that the anti-biotechnology people have made such an extreme about Frankenfoods and this kind of that I believe there are some potential positive things that can come from biotechnology and that can be useful, but only if we don't, for instance, allow all of this sort of stuff to be patented, all the techniques, everything, and to simply be used to enhance the wealthiest people. But I think that that it's a shame that things have gotten so totally polarized. It's very difficult to have a discussion in which you to say, you know, where is this place in which, in fact, some of this stuff could be useful? Because certainly the scientists out there, maybe you, people are always saying, you know, well, it's, this kind of food, it should be labeled, and I agree, it should be labeled. And I, but I, if you talk to scientists who are involved in this, and you say, well, you know, what do you think about that? Shouldn't, you know, these biogenetically engineered foods be labeled? And they say, absolutely. But that's a, it's different to say they should be labeled than to say we ought to stop all research and everything in this area. And in fact, what they will say is, but there also ought to be labels for you to find out all the chemicals and stuff that have been used on the food that you eat. The, you know, what pesticides, what other kinds of things went into the food, because some of the biotech is designed so that less of those chemicals may be necessary. And I think the issue is tremendously complex, and it really is a matter of how this stuff is, how we find ways so that this, if it is used, it can serve people and not simply make the situation worse. We have to be very careful about potential dangers from it, but it's not as if our contemporary, our existing traditional food systems, right, you know, is free from these dangers, and in fact may be more dangerous. Any other? Well, I think it's about lunchtime, since we've been talking about food, and you could be happy that you're getting organic food here, and hope everybody's ready to eat. Thank you all for coming.